Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
It was embarrassing. I thought that was embarrassing.
And the dogs are tied to people who are on skis.
It's graffiti, I guess, but with knit fabric.
It's easy to understand it in your head. It's a different thing to try to bring it to your dinner table and explain it to your family and go, this is something I'm really keen on.
Celebrating spring. From the studios of KUOM Radio K, this is Culture Cube, the arts show that rocks. Tickets are free and there's no wait, so take a seat and hold on to your radio. Well, folks, we've made it to May. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Krista Deborini. From the brutal breath of winter to the soggy spring, with finals week on the horizon, we have made it this far. Let Culture Cube bolster you through the homestretch with a soothing dose of award-winning local arts and culture coverage. Our show is packed with revitalizing bits of delicious Minnesota cuisine and the skinny on the video rental industry, along with many other fascinating stories. So put down that textbook and take a break. It's time for Culture Cube. All right, name three Swedish foods off the top of your head. If one of them is lutefisk, keep listening as reporter Eric Dolsky looks into why Swedish cuisine is acknowledged with only indifference and disgust as part of Minnesota's heritage.
Swedish food is one of those rare cuisines where the first thing you think of is usually the worst thing it has to offer.
If it's done well, it looks like this big sort of square glop, and it's white and a little yellow tinge to it.
That's, of course, lutefisk, everyone's favorite fish to hate.
As for least favorite, I think all Swedes hate surströmming. It's pickled Baltic herring. It's pretty disgusting. In Sweden, it's illegal to open it indoors of an apartment building because it smells so bad.
But there are good things.
There are these buns where they sort of carve out the inside and fill it with cream and then put the top back on it.
It's kind of like a cream puff. Yet we never hear about these good things, I suspect, because we're satisfied with accepting Swedish food based on its worst icons. That's called pandering to a nostalgic aging audience. But moving on, I'm not going to go so far as to claim Swedish food is making an incredible comeback right under your nose and that you can get in on the ground level before all your friends are eating Swedish food. But I will say that Swedish food is a little more amenable to a progressive lifestyle like the one you're so desperately trying to lead.
If I were to describe modern Swedish food, I would say that it still carries on a lot of the same characteristics that it had 100 years ago. It's still seasonal, regional. Swedish food is based on the climate there, so they have a very long winter and a very short growing period, so it's necessary to preserve food in the winter. So you'll see a lot of curing and pickling techniques for fish and vegetables and meats.
Pickling and curing may be better for you than sodium benzoate. Anyway, that's Patrice Johnson, a U of M extension teacher with an expertise in Swedish food and Swedish food ways.
It was really something I developed on my own. My mom is actually, I've noticed it's been pretty common that many women I've talked to did not learn to cook from their mothers. Our mothers were busy and needed to get in and out of the kitchen and they didn't need kids underfoot. And then once I had my own family, it became more of an interest and a passion.
And the laid-back guy you heard earlier.
My name is Ethan Poole and I study both linguistics and Scandinavian studies at the U of M and I'm an undergraduate. I'm president of the Svenska Klubben, which means the Swedish club.
Poole, like Johnson, got acquainted with all things Swedish, besides surströmming and lutefisk, post-adolescence. He's been to Sweden.
It kind of matched up with my expectations. A lot of people in cafes drinking coffee.
He's partaken of the Swedish table.
It's pickled Baltic herring.
And he's prepared to make statements about both things.
Swedes are very reserved. They tend to be moderate in everything in life, and they enjoy working kind of whatever they do. They're not really as focused on achieving some sort of, like, American dream. They tend to just enjoy life instead of focusing on trying to enjoy it. They just actually enjoy it.
Veiled mockery of the American dream? Probably yes. Deserved? Also, probably yes. But then that's how I, maybe how we, as Americans, interpret Swedish culture. Understated, straightforward, undefinably different, and people making the illogical, logical conclusions that we do conflate Swedish culture with Swedish cuisine.
It's very simple. I think of American food as being like big and bulky, Italian food having lots of spices in it, whereas Swedish food is very simple. Like, there are very few ingredients, and you don't eat as much of it.
Patrice Johnson says the same.
You use what you have. You cook it simply. You let the ingredients stand for themselves, stand on their own merit. I think the unpopular thing about Swedish cuisine is our misconception of it, that it's all white, it's all blah, there's no flavor. Lutefisk gets such a bad name, when really, if you break it down and have a really well-prepared lutefisk, I think it tastes like walleye. I've also had it taste like gelatin. But
that's pretty gross. And then the big question. Why aren't there any, like, huge Swedish restaurants like there are huge Chinese restaurants across America?
Probably because the food is kind of bland. I would admit that.
And that's the story of Swedish food as not just food, but as a cuisine. For now, it, like the fish it so often prepares, is in a state of decay. For Culture Q, I'm Eric Dolsky.
The restaurant industry is highly competitive, and sometimes it's hard for restaurateurs to attract customers. How is it that local restaurants keep getting people to walk through their doors? Monica Castleman investigates.
I love going out to eat. It's how I end up spending most of my money. I notice that I tend to gravitate towards family restaurants, and it turns out that I'm not the only one. I talked with Patty Keegan, the owner of Giacchino's Pasta and Pizza, to see how her family has kept customers coming in the door for the last 35 years.
Well, as my dad always says, it's easy to get them to come in the door. The hard part is getting them to come back, but hopefully they feel when they're here that they get a good value for their dollar. We are not the cheapest pizza place. We're not a coupon pizza place, but we want you to feel when you're done eating that you really got your money's worth.
It's true that Giacchino's isn't the cheapest pizza place that you'll find, but they definitely have some of the best food, which is probably why they have so many return customers.
Yeah, we have a very devoted group of people that are regular customers. We've had people that live in the neighborhood, have moved out, moving back to the neighborhood, and they still come in. We have second, sometimes third generation families coming in. So yeah, we have a pretty good customer base.
The Keegans achieve that loyal base of customers by taking time to get to know the people that walk through their door every day.
So, you know, if people are going to come in and spend money, they want to feel that they are special. And, you know, we have people, you know, that we know their names. We can't always remember their names, but we at least remember their faces. My dad was notorious for remembering everybody's orders. He could tell you today. He can't remember my name all the time, but he can tell you what, you know, one guy that came in, you know, a couple of years ago every Friday night used to order. So I think that really does make us a little unique in the fact that two people like to come in and know that the owner's there, you know, that somebody that isn't just a manager or isn't just an employee, that they have a lot more at stake.
With all the work that the Keegans have put into Giacchino's and making their guests feel at home every time they come in, it's no wonder that they still have such a strong following. But after all these years, the customers still have not stopped blowing Patty Keegan's mind.
You know, it is still amazing to me that with all the hundreds of places that people can come and eat, is that they get in their car and they decide that they're going to come to this little place on 36th in Chicago. That really, you know, blows my mind with all their other choices that they choose to come here. And so, you know, I do try to tell the staff and make sure that they are aware of that, because they could go anywhere. And they need to feel that we appreciate the fact that they chose to come here.
Thanks to Giacchino's loyal fans, I'm sure that the Keegans will be around for years to come. It's fantastic that local businesses that have been around for a while can keep their following of customers during these hard times. But what about those new restaurants? Andrew Sieve opened Hazel's Northeast with his brother just 5 months ago, and the response that they've been getting is better than anyone imagined.
It just spread through the neighborhood like wildfire, and it was so cool. I didn't think anyone would have the interest in what we're doing. I originally intended to open a restaurant that was going to fly under the radar, and we were just going to do what we do here. Hopefully people like it. Hopefully they show up. And I guess with who we've hired as a staff, the talent in the kitchen, the servers who are just professionals, we've been able to create a place that people like to come. And I guess there must be word on the street.
The success that Hazel's has been having isn't just a stroke of luck. Andrew and his brother Adam Sieve put a lot of time and energy into making the people that come into Hazel's feel welcome.
Just give them a couple minutes of your time and talk to them and tell them that you appreciate them coming in and supporting you and that they have 1,000 options in this city and they can go anywhere to get their food. And the fact that they come here, they made a choice, and we want to recognize that choice and that it's important to us. We buy a lot of desserts for people. Just dropping off a wine refill or a bread pudding on their table goes a long way and just makes them feel special. And that's what we want. This is a neighborhood joint. It's supported by people in a small radius. We want to make those people who make our livelihood feel special when they come here. So whatever they need, we'd love to give it to them.
The Sieves are lucky to have found such a great place for their family-owned restaurant. But I found that when it comes down to it, Andrew Sieve does not take his success lightly.
I'm just so happy to be pursuing my dreams, and it's been a very positive situation so far, and I hope it continues that way.
From the sounds of it, neither of these restaurants are in any danger of closing their doors. But they still need support of the community to stay open. Local businesses aren't always as successful as the ones that I've talked to, and it's important that these entrepreneurs have their shot at running a good restaurant. My advice to you, next time you're thinking about where to eat, venture over to a locally owned place. I guarantee that it'll be the best service you've ever had. With Culture Q, I'm Monica Castleman.
Usually, April showers bring May flowers, and with the deluge raining down on the Twin Cities this past week, we should expect veritable bouquets in our backyards. Culture Q's Yi-Chin Lee asked U of M students, if April showers bring May flowers, then what comes next?
Summer, sun and beach and weather and funness.
I would say lots of road construction.
After May flowers, I hope that the weather doesn't fluctuate like it always does here in Minnesota.
May rain, what comes next? Is this a riddle?
No.
What comes next? May rain, what comes next? What comes next? The drought of the summer? Yeah, the summer's really dry here, so yeah, we won't be getting much rain.
If May rain brings the flowers, what comes the next? Dancing in the streets?
June sun brings the sunbathers.
And if May rain brings the flowers, then June brings the heat.
Probably snow, because we're in Minnesota, it's pretty typical.
And apparently in Minnesota, it brings more snow.
If May rain brings the flowers, then hopefully there's no snow. I always thought, like, snowing in April. I'm like, so if April rains bring May flowers, then April snow brings what? I just hope it's summer.
If May rain comes, what comes next would be higher grasses to mow.
I guess if May rain brings the flowers, June brings the end of allergy season.
I guess what comes next is the green trees. I don't know. Starting to see some buds on the trees, and that's what I'm excited for.
After May rain comes the flowers, and then the May Day Parade, which is the best day of all time in Minneapolis, so everyone should go.
Everyone's happy?
I don't know, I guess I can only say the June sunshine.
Well, this is Eric Fun. If May brings flowers, what comes next is never what you're gonna expect.
Good evening, you're listening to Radio K's Culture Q. I'm your host, Christetta Barini, and today we're talking about the top 7 foreign holidays that Americans use as an excuse to drink. I'm joined in studio today by Tess Weinberg.
Hello.
So, Tess, what is our number 7 favorite foreign holiday to drink upon?
Number 7 is the Chinese New Year, and I believe that this year was the year of the ox, and the holiday was on February 3rd, because it changes every year, because the calendar is different.
Right, changes by the moon, so we can have rice wine with the Chinese New Year.
Yummy.
All right, so what's our number 6 favorite drinking holiday?
Number 6 is Bastille Day, which is the French Independence Day. There's lots of fireworks, and I hear that there's also a lot of sales. So if you like shopping, go to France during this time.
That sounds like a great idea. Good excuse to get to Paris.
Mm-hmm. As if we need one.
What is our number 5?
Number 5 is Guy Fawkes Day. It's kind of the anarchy holiday. Do you want to talk about this one a little bit?
Sure. In the UK, there was an anarchist who wanted to blow up the Parliament building. His name was Guy Fawkes. And so Guy Fawkes Day is the anniversary of his execution. And it's kind of celebrated the same way we do Independence Day. So there's a lot of fireworks, some like bonfires in the streets, and of course, lots and lots of good, strong English ale. Mm-hmm. So what is our next favorite holiday? Number four.
Number 4 is Mardi Gras. And it happens on Fat Tuesday, right before Ash Wednesday. And I'm sure you've all heard of this. There's lots of drinking and fun masks involved.
Big parades, and New Orleans is the best place to celebrate it in
the U.S.
It's a happening place, indeed. So what is our number 3 favorite holiday to drink upon?
Number 3 is Oktoberfest, and it takes place in Germany, and it's the whole month of October. So if you like beer, this is the month for you in Germany.
Mm-hmm. Celebrating the harvest and all of the good grains that make beer. How about our number 2 favorite holiday for drinking?
Number 2 is St. Patrick's Day, an Irish holiday. And I'm sure some of you have had the green beer at the bars out there. Super fun holiday to celebrate.
And number 1 is
Cinco de Mayo, which is coming up. And it's the Mexican Independence Day, and it's a great excuse to drink lots of tequila.
Perfect. Well, thank you for joining me today in studio, Tess. And once again, those were your top 7 favorite foreign holidays to drink.
Thanks.
Every tiny online store and big ticket gaming system demands some of our most private, personal information before we can access services. Joe Kral gives us advice on how to navigate the waters of internet privacy in the digital age.
If you own a Sony PlayStation 3, you have probably noticed that for a little over a week now, you've been unable to connect to the PlayStation Network. You're not the only one. Following attacks by hackers on April 17th and 19th, Sony formally shut down the network to investigate one of the largest security breaches in recent memory. While it now appears that no credit card information was obtained in the attack, Sony has admitted to coughing up personal information, including names, addresses, phone numbers, email addresses, birth dates, and passwords for its over 77 million user accounts. In light of such events, I sat down with Gareth McMaster, the manager of the Carlson School's IT Student Services Help Desk, to talk a little bit about data security and the internet age. So, Gareth, you know, looking at the results of this attack, do you think users were somewhat at fault for giving up so much data about themselves?
That's pretty difficult. I mean, in this day and age, you're going to have to hand over some private data in order to get services you want. That's sort of part of the Faustian bargain people have agreed to with the internet these days, especially when they use the internet to buy services from large companies such as Sony or Amazon.
Well, should we be able to expect those companies to protect our data then, or is that just sort of a implicit risk of the internet?
Whether you can expect them to protect your data, I can't even begin to answer that. They have certain liability when it comes to your data, and that's the only thing I see working for you in the equation, that they can end up on the wrong end of a large class action lawsuit. That doesn't necessarily help you when you've had your bank account raided by a hacker.
All right. Now, fair enough. So what are some of the things that maybe students can do to protect their data and to ensure their own security online?
Let's see. Not only use complex passwords, but use different passwords for different sites. If you use the same password on several important sites, having it compromised once by a piece of malware on your computer means now they have access to an array of information about you, from whether it's your password used for Facebook, and then you use it on your in your banking and your credit cards. Use complex passwords and use different passwords for different sites.
I heard you mention malware in there. What, how big of a deal is malware, and what can students do to try and protect themselves from viruses and stuff like that?
Updates for your operating system are crucial. These usually come out weekly or biweekly, especially if you're using Windows. There are three updates in particular that you need to keep an eye on. The first is obviously Windows itself. Windows updates are important to run as often as you can. The second is Java. Now, usually certain sites and applications require you to install Java, and it usually comes with its own updater, which will pop up intermittently. Always run Java updates. Third, Flash. Flash runs things like YouTube and various other sites like that, and a lot of other applications use Flash. Flash games. Everybody has Flash. Everybody has Java installed on their machine. Both of these applications/frameworks are crucial avenues for malware to infect your machine. If these two pieces of software are not up to date, you don't have to do anything wrong to acquire a piece of malware. You can merely go to a website.
What do you mean, go to a website? Like, go to a hacker's website, or what are you talking about?
A couple years ago, there were advertising networks that served up ads on sites such as Fox News or the New York Times. Merely visiting web pages that on those sites, because the advertising networks were infected, could infect your machine through no fault of your own. So while downloading an application that you're not sure of and running it is a common way of acquiring malware, merely visiting a website, accidentally or on purpose, without having done anything beyond that, is a method of acquiring malware, especially if you do not keep Flash and Java up to date.
Wow. Okay. Well, those are some pretty good tips. And I guess for more tips, students can go to http://privacy.ahc.umn.edu. For Culture Q, I'm Joe Kroll, and this is Gareth McMaster.
Some might say Blockbuster falling into bankruptcy after having put many independent video rental stores out of business is the perfect example of karma. However, while few and far between, some local video rental stores still survive to quietly judge our choice of movies. Mark Sheely has the story.
Something strange in your neighborhood. Who you gonna call?
Imagine the perfect video store. It would have a great selection, right? Right! Over.
As you can probably tell from the audio quality of this video rental ad, this comes from the 1990s. These were the glory days of brick-and-mortar video rental, especially one particular chain.
Video store.
Welcome to Blockbuster Video!
Is popping up all over the country.
And it was this push by Blockbuster to establish themselves almost everywhere that shuttered many independent video rental stores.
And I used to have a map where I had all these, had it marked where all these stores were. And
this is Scott Prost, owner of Video Universe in Robbinsdale, one of the few remaining independent video stores in the metro area. He says that other stores simply couldn't compete with the depth of Blockbuster's new release selection.
Once they came around, they played a lot of games with the studios that's when you saw the real increase in depth of copy, where you'd have hundreds of copies of the new releases, and that made it very hard for a lot of the independent stores to compete.
However, in pushing small video rental stores out of business, Blockbuster racked up a lot of debt, about $900 million by the time they filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy last September. Add the huge increase in the number of Netflix subscriptions, and the arrival of red box kiosks in places like McDonald's and grocery stores. And suddenly this other Blockbuster ad has a much more ominous message than the one it carries.
Someday, you'll remember where you were when you first heard that there are no more late fees at Blockbuster.
Well, it's really a double-edged sword, I guess. I mean, it's nice to not have competition, but on the other hand, you do see that as more and more of these places close, it loses visibility as an option for people to, as a way to get movies for people.
However, Prost believes that his store still has something that neither subscription services nor Redbox kiosks can offer.
We've got a huge selection of stuff that you can just get when you want to see it. Netflix streaming is really limited. You know, people are real happy with it for a while because it's great. You know, you've got quite a bit of stuff there when you first start it, but you go through the stuff you want to see, and all of a sudden it's like, hey, you know, I need more stuff. And the other big loss is the ability for people to browse. I mean, you can browse online, but it's a totally different thing than walking around a store just kind of picking up boxes and reading the back of it. Or you'll also lose the input from, you know, the video people that work at the video stores that have something to say about the movies.
I think there's something to be said for being afraid to walk up to a clerk with bad movies, so you got to dig around a little harder.
John Smith, a clerk at Filmzilla Video Rental in the Seward neighborhood, says that while video clerks are often seen as snarky and judgmental, they're also valuable in steering people towards movies they may like.
Yeah, would like to poke fun, but also the flip side to that is, if you know, you are renting something, we will point you in the direction of more things like that. If you're renting a 10-year-old Japanese action movie, you may not know about the things that have happened in the last 10 years. We can help you with that.
This kind of niche catalog is also something Prost believes essential to any independent video store's survival.
I mean, now it absolutely is probably more niche genres with people being able to get the newest releases out of the Redbox. But, I think that for any video store nowadays to survive, you have to have a wide selection of titles, and that's part of the reason Blockbuster just got hammered out.
Prost also believes that the future is not yet set for a subscription service like Netflix.
I can see Netflix eventually really getting squeezed out by the studios, and maybe they'll all have their own form of streaming and all that, because at this point, Netflix is just, it's too low priced. I mean, they offer for $7.99 unlimited streaming, and that is, in terms of entertainment value, it's just ridiculously low. People are cutting their cord on their cable, and things will change down the road for that.
Indeed, in a 2008 deal, the Starz TV channel gave Netflix their entire catalog for streaming for about $35 million. That same deal, if done today, is valued at around $250 million. And there are still content providers like HBO that refuse to give over their shows to Netflix Instant Watch, hoping to develop their own online streaming services. However, as long as Netflix is still here, does Prost believe that his video rental store and others like it can survive alongside the new model?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know how long video rental has in it. Is it 3 years, 5 years, 10 years? I don't know. Things are moving pretty darn fast. You know, we will survive alongside them as long as we can, but I think we're still better.
For Culture Q, I'm Mark Sheely.
This week's stories were brought to you by Eric Dolsky, Monica Castleman, Yichen Lee, Joe Krall, Tess Weinberg, and Mark Sheely. Producers for Culture Q are Eric Dolsky, Joe Krall, and Mark Sheely. Our culture coach is Sarah Lemanchek. Host and managing editor is me, Christetta Borini. If you missed something fascinating, you can always find Culture Q online at RadioK.org. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.